farming. Even the word itself conjures up an image of a simpler time, when our values made more sense, when we grew what we ate, sold what was left over, and lived in harmony with the land. So what if I told you that one of the most exciting young companies in agriculture is returning us to the values of this old-fashioned way of life by adding just one small new ingredient, robots? That's today on The Q Factor. Welcome back to The Q Factor. I'm Greg Fisher. My guest and subject matter today really sums up one of the core values of this series, which is this: progress can never go backwards. The only way forward is through. Eric Adamson is the founder and CEO of a brilliant young company called Tortuga AgTech. Tortuga means turtle, which Eric chose because of its long-standing symbol as a wise, thoughtful member of the animal kingdom. And AgTech stands for agricultural technology. And the technology part of that phrase is just as important as the agriculture. Eric is the grandson of a farmer, and he retains his grandfather's old-fashioned values. But he knows recreating his grandfather's working conditions just won't work. What's required, according to Eric, is a data-driven embrace of cutting-edge tools and techniques like robotics, artificial intelligence, and predictive analytics. Marrying quantitative research with the age-old needs of the farm is the only way for modern farmers to survive, thrive, and continue to be what our planet desperately needs, to remain the heartbeat of the human food service business. Let's keep in mind that agriculture and food-related industries comprise over 5% of U.S. GDP. That's well over $1 trillion a year. The mandate is clear. We've got to get this right. Here's my interview with Eric Adamson. Eric, thanks for joining me on The Q Factor today.
Thanks for having me. Very excited to be here.
We are as well. So let's jump right in. Your business, Tortuga AgTech. We got to hear more about this concept of AgTech, but is it at its essence farming plus robots equals better farming? I'm oversimplifying this, but that's basically the heart of your business, right? Can you give us a little more detail in general?
Absolutely. I actually love the simplification. We try to do this with our farming customers who, at the end of the day, it's not complicated. We're trying to help them do their jobs better. And our mission reflects that. You know, our mission is to build a healthier society and a thriving planet through smarter farming. And the way we choose to do that is with robots at the center of the farming operation. So the only evolution of what you said, farming plus robots equals better farming, is how do you define better? And we define better as more profitable, lower risk, more sustainable, more equitable, higher quality. But ultimately, I think that's a fair simplification.
Let's think about this, you know, higher quality, more cost efficient, more profitable.
Yes.
I don't think a lot of our listeners may even know what agricultural technology is. I think when we picture farming, we're picturing farming the way we remember it. I remember reading years ago, and I might be wrong about this, but I think it was like the Israelis who kind of developed this technology for drip irrigation. I remember people explaining to me that, you know, imagine a big farm and there's different kinds of things. There's lettuce, there's tomatoes, there's cucumbers, and each of these items needs a different amount of water, different times of the day, different amounts of sunlight, and that somehow there was some technology back in like the 70s that treated each of these things a little differently. But now fast forward to today. Here we are, it's 2021. What is agricultural technology today? What is all this stuff?
Great question. And I think it's important to stay grounded in the reality of things that you just said. For example, irrigation is agriculture technology, and drip irrigation, while very obvious to us today, was maybe not obvious when, you know, the Israelis and others pioneered it. In the same sense, a tractor is a very old technology today, but only 100 years ago, it was actually a fairly new technology for a lot of broadacre production. Today doesn't look all that dissimilar from decades ago because agriculture, I wouldn't say is not innovative. I actually think farmers are very innovative, but what they are is also very, very practical. And they face very, very practical challenges. And if the technology doesn't help them address those challenges, then it is not a technology that they will adopt. So while there is a lot of exciting new technology like robotics and various data gathering approaches, a lot of the technology that's been widely adopted on farm are things that you and I might not think of as extremely highly technological, but are in fact extremely effective. Things that move things around easily, things that help you conserve water and drip water. There are control systems around some of these more controlled environment grows, like glass houses or tunnel systems, and they have these large pumping systems and fairly sophisticated control software that pumps the right amount of fertilizers and water to the plants at the right times. But even that is fairly straightforward technology. It's just executed very well.
So part of this is about developing technologies that the farmers will use because it solves some practical problem.
Exactly.
That I think is critical because ultimately humans are still involved in all this, right? Like how much of all this ag tech is trying to replace humans versus to augment what humans do?
We believe that it's almost augmenting the human as opposed to replacing the human. Now, you might replace a particular task that humans have to do, but there will always be, I believe, always be humans on farm, always be humans helping to make good decisions, and always be humans doing actual physical work on the farm. And that's just simply a function of the complexity and the detail involved in farming. You know, I think sort of the three big problems that we talk about that farmers always face, right? The first and foremost is sort of what environment are they in? What is their climate? What are they growing? And what local pests and diseases are there, or like water pressures are there? And these things are getting harder and harder for farmers around the world. But that's kind of like, what is the broader environment that a farmer is in? And that's massively a challenge that they face. And then the next big challenge is labor. It's hard work. So a major challenge in global agriculture today is a labor shortage.
Labor seems to be a problem today for a lot of reasons, but that's
exactly yeah. And the pandemic has sort of revealed these labor shortages in all kinds of industries, but the agriculture industry, this is nothing new. It's just extra bad now. But if you think about what farming is, it's okay, you're in an environment, you have a thing that you want to grow, and you want to grow it before other things eat it. And you then have to do a bunch of literal physical work to make that thing grow and then to get it to the market where you sell it.
Wait a second. I mean, I'm not a farmer and many people listening. So wait, you want to grow it before other things eat it? You mean like insects and things
like that? Exactly. Yes. That's one of the major pressures that farmers face, right? It's how do we stop other things, microbes, fungi, and pests from eating the food that we want to eat first? And this is a major consideration. So, you know, what environment and pest pressures do we have? How do we do the work to actually get the thing from a seed or an early plant to a product that is actually sellable? And then how do we get that product to the market? And lastly, the major challenge that farmers always face is a lack of information, which starts to tie into all of the areas you're really passionate about. How do you know what hard work to do? How do you know where the pest pressures or the water pressures are really, really bad? And how do you maintain and manage this system, this complex biological system over many, many months to get yourself to a profitable harvest? And those are the three main challenges. And so any agricultural technology must help address those challenges in a very, very practical and tangible way.
That's interesting. I always love lists of three. It makes things so organized.
Yeah.
Let's double click on each one. The first one you mentioned is sort of the environment or weather. So I think about this in my own work. So in the investment business, there's all these alternative and new data sources we have access to today. I remember years ago when I grew up, my father owned a little men's clothing business in Queens, New York, one of these small stores you don't see around anymore. I think one of the reasons I got into statistics is what my dad would do every day in a little one of those black and white notebooks is he would write down the amount of sales that he did each day and what the weather was. Was it raining or snowing or whatever? And he did this every year for like 30 years. And then if let's just say it was a Tuesday in March and sales weren't as much as he thought, he'd go back to the prior year or the year before and he said, well, it's clear. It was sunny that day and today it was raining. Therefore, that's why my sales were down. And he was trying to correlate weather with his sales. But these days, you sort of can't get away with that. Like I think of one business, they sell the food that the farmers make and maybe their sales were down recently. And they were saying, you know, it was the weather. But these days, we have data on every day of every year, of every quarter, what the trends were, what the weather was. So we can parse out and say, were sales down because the weather was substantially different than a week ago, a month ago, a quarter of ago? We can sort that by region, by where their stores are. So like weather can no longer be an excuse for a business. That's something that I can think about around how new data around weather, for example, might impact the decisions that we make in business. But how does the new data available about weather maybe affect the farmers and their environment? And how do you deal with that?
Yeah, this is a great question. I think the analogy to make it applicable to agriculture, you'd almost have to add a feature that not only does the weather potentially impact the buyers, but it also impacts the product itself. So imagine if you had two rainy weeks in a row and now your suits that you're selling are actually worse than they were, you know, or you have fewer of them than you thought you would have. So right. The sort of dynamicism of supply and demand to external factors makes agriculture exceptionally complex. Now, the data that we can gather with our robots and then external data that we don't have any influence on, like the local weather or the short-term climate, you can use that data and try to do things like predict, well, our robots count individual berries, right? And we count them better than anyone has ever counted them before. And so we're now getting to a point where we have an inventory for a farmer's fruit where they've never had that information before. That's really, really helpful. But the weather still has a massive impact on the quality of that fruit 3 weeks from now and the size of that fruit 3 weeks from now. So we have some information on things we can control, some information on things we can't. Now let's do some fairly sophisticated statistics and more sophisticated as the seasons go to try to estimate how much we're going to have. And that actually helps them to go and have those conversations with their own customers who are supermarkets and say, hey, we're going to have 1,000 tons in the next X weeks. And I want to place that volume with you. Can I help you know that you need a promotion or what is the quality of that fruit as it's coming online so that we have a general sense of, is there going to be a chance to price up or price down? Or how do I just make sure I place all this volume? That's a major question for farmers today. Trading is a massive industry in broadacre and cereal crops. But in fruits and vegetables, which are more perishable, it's more about getting them to the market and getting value for that before they go bad, before they go to waste, before they have to be thrown, literally thrown away. So that's the first and most powerful, I think, application of some of the data that we have about weather and also some of the data we have about the farms themselves.
So the technology can do sort of a better job predicting in advance what your inventory and the quality of that inventory might be. So you could sort of go out and ship it, you know, you could sell it in advance based upon what yield you're likely to have.
Exactly. The yield and the quality will provide better conversations with your customers about how much you're going to have as a simple question, but also how good that quality will be. And that helps them to manage their supply chain. Because obviously, we've seen massive innovations in manufacturing and supply chain over the last 50 to 70 years. But a lot of those goods are not perishable goods. The perishability of the agricultural supply chain makes this whole thing way more tricky, particularly in things like fruits and vegetables, which are the highest value and also the things that we really want to eat and also the things that can go badly very quickly. So we're trying to bring just some of the basics from manufacturing and supply chain knowledge in other industries and apply them to the farm with better data. And it's not that these people haven't already been, you know, a lot of farmers have been fairly sophisticated with their supply chain management, or, you know, supermarkets very sophisticated with their supply chain management. But the element that they don't have any knowledge about is what's happening on the farm in a very specific and granular detail. And that is the element that we're trying to sort of solve with Tortuga as well.
So cool. The second thing you mentioned was labor as another yes. one of those three items that this is hoping to solve. And you touched on it a little bit already. But one of the things that caught my attention when you're talking about, like, someone probably used to go out and pick strawberries by hand and put them in a bucket or something. And were they actually counting how many strawberries they were collecting? Or was there some machine they'd dump them in that would count how many strawberries? Or would they just estimate how many strawberries would fit in a bucket? How did that work? I mean, technology's done some interesting things for all of us. The one thing it definitely has done is made arithmetic almost free, right? We don't have to add anymore or count. Maybe it's a nice thing for a farmer not to have to like think about that problem anymore. It frees them up to focus their energy on the higher value activities. But talk to us a little bit about like labor and how this technology is making it better. Maybe use your counting of strawberries as one example.
Yeah. And there's sort of the two factors of counting that you mentioned. One is the counting that we just talked about, which is I want an inventory of all of the fruit and vegetables in my grow. And I then have that information that helps me plan and sell. But the other aspect is very micro, which is if you go to the store today, every piece of fruit and vegetable in that fresh produce area has probably been touched by a human, except for things like potatoes and carrots, which are sort of more automated these days. But every strawberry, every blueberry that you see was probably touched by a human being. And they're not counting and remembering, but they are actually still today counting how many berries go into that little container. And they're estimating how much weight wow. there is in that container and trying to get it roughly right, which of course leads to massive inefficiency because then the farm says, well, we don't want to underpack, so let's just overpack. So now we're giving away 10 to 20% of our volume oh, wow. just to make sure that it gets to the supermarket with enough weight so that we're not going to get penalized.
I'm sure somebody's looked at this, but like how much variance was there across the people estimating? Was it pretty tight? Like were these farmers doing a pretty good job estimating these sorts of things in the past, or was it like a really wide variance?
There's a very wide variance. And so again, on the sort of two jobs, there's the forecasting job. Sometimes the variance is exceptionally high. I think with a couple of farms we've been working with, mean average error from week to week on your forecast can be up to 50%, sometimes 100% off. You might wow. get double of what you thought because you just didn't get a good estimate. Sometimes right on, but oftentimes very variably off. So that's the sort of bigger forecasting job. But then even this micro job of like, I am a picker and I am going through and I'm picking fruit and I pack it. And for something like a strawberry, it cannot be sorted after the fact because it's so delicate. Raspberries are even more delicate. Blackberries are the same. Blueberries, you can kind of pick into a bucket. And then there's oftentimes these big sorting machines that sort of sort out by size. And then they sort of go to the market. But for things like strawberries and even things of certain types of tomatoes, you really can't do much with them. You have to pick them gently and basically pack them to where they're going to go right away. And those are also highly variable. So if I'm a picker, I'm incentivized to pick very, very quickly. I have to do this job of counting, but I don't really want to do that job of counting. So I'm going to do the bare minimum of that job. And instead, I'm going to pick as fast as I can because that's how I'm getting my extra bonus.
Oh, that's cool.
What a robot can do is a robot can know very, very well and very consistently how to count and how to pack and how to estimate the weight, predict the weight and put it into the right punnet. And that can actually reduce downstream quality control costs for the farm and the supermarket who are themselves trying to catch these problems that happen in the field. So by doing this one job really well in the field, you actually solve problems down the chain, which is why doing something on farm is so valuable versus doing it after the fact.
That's so cool. Does some of the stuff already show up in prices for the end consumer? Like what you just described sounds incredibly more efficient than it used to be and probably reduces a lot of costs, labor being yes. one of them, of course, but there's others, waste, et cetera. Have yeah. we seen that in the reduction of the prices of these things as the end consumer?
Not yet. I mean, this is still fairly early days. There is a huge amount of potential in this type of technology to reduce prices for end consumers and to sort of basically reclaim a bunch of value back from lost value in waste. And there's a future that we've modeled out pretty extensively where the supermarkets still make their margin, the farmers make a better margin, and the customer pays less because you're actually just getting value back that is typically being thrown away. That future, we absolutely firmly believe in, but I don't think it's happening today yet because it's still very early stages of getting this kind of technology out into farms and fully deployed and fully penetrated into these markets.
I mean, I think those of us who do a lot of data work like you and me, there are probably multiple futures, right? You just described one future, but what are some other potential futures that exist in your models?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the future where customers pay more because the quality of the fruit is better and they're willing to pay it. Right now, I think there's been in the last 20 to 30 years, a little more price discrimination around things like organic, which we can talk about later. But with better quality product, customers do pay for that, you know, and we've seen that in a lot of different areas. So one area is maybe just the value is claimed by everybody, but the monetary value, the profit is claimed more in the producer, the farms or the supermarkets. I think there's also potential future, which I don't think we necessarily believe in, but there's a chance that farmers get pressed, you know? And so actually the farm sort of continues to reduce prices and the surplus value accumulates to the end consumer or to the supermarket. But we believe with more information and more control over the production, farmers will finally be able to fight back a little bit over some of the pricing here, particularly in the high value fruits and vegetables. And that's one of the reasons why we exist is we really want to help farmers to combat the pressures and the risks that they face more than any other actor in the supply chain.
Thinking about how to combine all that with different locations, one of the third things you mentioned was where. I think you might have been thinking about the location of the farms, maybe. But I'm thinking about we all have different utility functions, right?
Yeah.
Like I personally prefer paying a little less for a banana. If it has a little bit of a brown thing on the yellow, totally. It's fine with me. I'll just, you know, pay a little less and eat it anyway. My yeah. wife, on the other hand, has to have the most perfect strawberry. So there must be some way these days with all the consumer behavior data to take the data that you just described, combined with the location, where the store is, what the customers are, who's walking in the store, and just tee up the proper banana for me, which might be a little less perfect than the proper banana for my wife, right? I'm guessing this is going there sooner or later.
I really think so. And I think that the challenge is, again, that the data from the supply side, there are a number of companies that are already working in supermarkets around management of the fresh produce section. I actually have a couple friends who started one called AFresh. And the challenge is you don't know very much about what's in that container that comes from the farm. And so if you can connect that data and that approach with the data coming from the farm, I think you can really start to price discriminate around this. And if you connect that with robotics, you can start thinking about packing to different sizes and weights, and that can be something that people will pay more for. Something we've talked to a lot of farmers about, which is very exciting to them, is we only have pound or 2 pound containers because that's what's easy to pack into. But what if you could have a sleeve of 4 to 5 strawberries, and that's a competition with a candy bar now? If it's fresh enough and if it's tasty enough, there's no reason why we couldn't break the sort of bulk approach and start giving different types of value to different types of consumers and collecting that value for the consumer and for the producer. And I think this is where very, very early stages of all of this kind of idea in fruits and vegetables, but there's an extreme amount of potential to add value to society and add value to the profitability of the whole chain in doing these kinds of things.
I gotta say, on your website, which everybody listening should check out. What's your website address?
It's pretty easy. So it's tortuga.ag. So that's tortuga as in turtle in Spanish, and then .ag for ag.
Your website's super cool. It's got this really gorgeous strawberry on it that I really wanted to eat.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's all these machines moving around. But let's talk a little about these robots. I'm curious, is your business to actually design and build the robots, or do you partner with robot manufacturers around the globe for that? How does that work?
Great question. We do design and build our own robotic stack in-house. So that includes hardware design, software design, machine learning, and artificial intelligence as well. And we started from the very beginning with this thesis, which is different than other folks in robotics. We believe that the best way to get the value out of all of these technological innovations that combine into robotics is to focus on one problem and then to design the solution for that problem. So rather than taking an off-the-shelf robot arm that has been developed to do a lot of different things, some of which might be lifting a really heavy thing or moving really, really quickly, we have a system that's very robust to the problem we are trying to solve and that can solve that problem better than any other system. But we can't do anything else. We're not going to be good at picking up a toy out of a bin in a warehouse. But that robot would never be able to be cost-effective or effective doing the job in our environment. And then if you think about how do you move that robot arm around the grow, well, you can't really buy an off-the-shelf system there either. What you really want to do is integrate an entire system that does all these jobs that are really close to each other on the farm that a human picker has to do really, really well at a really low price point. And that is what we're doing that is different than anybody else. So our robots are orders of magnitude lower cost than other folks who have tried to build robots to do this kind of thing. And they are more effective. And that is because we've done the hard engineering work to focus on just the problem we're trying to solve, picking fruit and vegetables, and not an arm that can do a lot of different things, but then is over-optimized in some areas and over-costed in some areas.
I'm thinking about how these robots do a better job picking strawberries than a human being would.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sure there's a lot that goes into this and probably more than we can cover, but maybe you could give us a couple examples. Like the whole idea of artificial intelligence and prediction technology. Mm-hmm. I think prior to AI and machine learning, I think prediction was like the one thing that human beings could do that machines couldn't do. Mm-hmm. But now AI is basically a prediction technology. It does that for us and perhaps even better than we would have done. And I'm wondering, what types of predictive analysis are you using with this information? Does a robot, like every time it picks a third strawberry on a Tuesday at 1 when the sun is shining, it doesn't work well, so it knows not to do that anymore? Like, how does this work?
Great question. And I think fundamentally it comes down to sort of what is a human better than a robot at and what is a robot better than a human at? We always start with the basics because the basics are where the real value starts. One of the basics is just predicting the size of a single berry. So a human being, if you pick 1,000 strawberries yourself, you'll get pretty good at generally knowing how big is that berry. But robots are still better. And robots are better and more consistent over many, many, many hours and many, many days. One thing that the robots do better than humans is stay consistent in estimating weights. Another thing that we do better at consistently and even at the peak is picking a berry that is actually ready to be picked, ripeness, which is generally mostly a function of color. But there are also some other elements that you have to pay attention to as well. And a human being, again, being incentivized to move quickly, they're kind of pushing the envelope of what should be picked and what shouldn't be picked, because they just want to pick a lot of things really, really fast. A robot is very good at saying, I'm just going to do what you told me to do, wherever you wanted me to pick that day, that's the threshold that I'm going to look at. And there may be some error around that, but it's way less than the error of a human picker. And then another thing that robots are just better at than humans is taking care of the fruit. So because humans are moving absolutely as quickly as they can, picking, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 berries into their hand at a time, and then they dump them into the punnet or the container, they can bruise fruit. And that bruising can be very, very bad downstream. It can lead to waste. It can lead to unhappy consumers. So robots can actually already do better on that. And lastly, robots are just, as you might imagine, very consistent in doing the hard work that they do. You know, our robots can work for 12 hours and they don't really change their pace or anything like that. Human beings, of course, very up and down. And especially in the last year, a lot of our growers have had major problems with COVID outbreaks. So less reliable on whether or not you're going to have a workforce that day. So robots can sort of solve that problem. In terms of the immediate short-term predictive analytics, it really is mostly around, am I thinking that I'm seeing the thing that I'm seeing? Am I picking that thing and I'm putting it in the punnet in the right way? As good as humans are today already, and in the future, the near future for us, you know, as we start predicting, okay, yesterday I saw this berry number 10,345 in this row. I expect it to be ripe today, so I'm going to be ready to pick it when I show up to that location. That is something that we're actively working on developing. And then you can start thinking about optimizing the entire harvest operation. Where am I going to be putting which robots and how fast am I going to be expecting them to pick and so on? That's just around the corner, but it's not happening yet today.
That's exciting to me. That last thing you mentioned, I could just imagine that. And I keep reading about how we learn more from the 4th observation than the 100th observation, but we learn more from the 1,000th observation than the 5,000th observation. Like, I guess it becomes pretty inexpensive for robots to just keep studying this stuff versus when we had to do like regressions on a spreadsheet or something, it was a little more time consuming. So it's exciting to think about all of that, but it also has me wonder, there must be a situation that you've learned where humans just simply do it better.
Oh yeah.
And I'm wondering, like in farming and agriculture, what are some of those examples where the machines just can't compete?
Totally. There's sort of a broader answer in robotics on this, but it's particularly important for what we do. You know, humans, we're pretty amazing, actually, in dexterous tasks. We're a result of millions of years of evolution. We're quite good at picking fruit. We're quite good at picking things out of areas or sort of analyzing complex and unexpected situations. And so we aren't as fast as humans. We're much slower than a really fast human being, and we're slower than some average human beings at some farms. And that's just because people are very good at sort of manipulating with their hands and moving their fingers around to get around different things. And that's something that robots are not very good at. If you've ever watched the DARPA competitions of robots trying to open a doorknob, right, it's actually surprisingly difficult to teach a machine to do that. And that's something that I don't think that robots overcome anytime soon, not because robots couldn't, but because of the trade-off between the cost of that robot that can do that and the value of what that task is. So, you know, I think what we're trying to do is we're trying to be affordable for the grower at a cost that they pay, but we don't have to necessarily do it in the same way that a human can. I think this applies to a lot of robotics. Robotics doesn't have to be better, faster, stronger, more reliable on every dimension. Robotics can be slower if it's better quality. It can be slower if it's lower cost. It can be faster in some aspects like automation, but you might lose some of the quality control that humans would have provided if you did it with human beings. So there's always trade-offs that you have to think about. And it's really about, in robotics and in AI, I think, what am I willing to lose to get this extra benefit over here? Because you're never going to get everything better all the time, at least not in the early days of robotics, which I still think we are in.
I know that you stress that your goal is not to replace the growers with robotics and AI. I know that's an important part of your company, and I think that's important to understand that. But when you talk to your clients, do they fear otherwise? You know, there's, I think, this ongoing narrative around technology and robots replacing humans and the challenges in industrial policy in America, particularly in farming, as we look forward.
I don't think that our farmer customers are concerned at all. from the farm management point of view, I mean, until AI can run a business, which is, I think, a really long way off, a lot of the management structure will remain in place. What robots will help them to do is what people call the dull, dirty, and dangerous jobs, and the really, really repeatable jobs. And that's more of a question of the sort of humans who are currently picking fruit or humans who are currently trimming off bad leaves or bad pieces of the plant that you don't want there. Humans that are sort of doing a spraying job, you know, we can take those hours away and then you don't have to have a person completely wrapping themselves up in protective equipment and spending all night driving a chemical sprayer through a grow. That's something that people don't really want to do, but they'll do it if you pay them enough money. But really fewer and fewer people want to do that. So even when you talk to the workers on the farm, at the farms that we work at, they're not even really too afraid either, because they know there's so many jobs that are actually not being done today because there's such a labor shortage. I mean, farms that we work with are failing to harvest 20, 30% of their fruit and vegetables, which is mind-boggling because that's money that's sitting there for them. But they don't have the people to do it. I don't think anybody's too concerned about robots or AI taking their jobs away. It really is sort of a co-robotics situation in agriculture. And I honestly think it's probably going to be that way for a lot of restaurants as well. Do you want the back of the house automated or the front of the house automated? You know, right. There's going to be value to customer service. We are still human beings who appreciate relationships. Maybe the front of the house is a human and the back of the house is automated. Maybe it's the other way around if what you're cooking is really complicated. But I really don't think there's a lot of places where the entirety of a thing is going to be replaced by robotics and AI. I think there are going to be very, very clear verticals within a business or a job that are totally automated. And it's the same kind of what happened in many industries in the last 30 years.
Yeah, it's very important and helpful to hear. That's a good analogy on the restaurants. I've been working for a couple of years with a group of people that we created something called the Jobs Quality Index.
Yes.
And we've been tracking the low quality jobs in America versus the high quality jobs in America, and just looking at this problem and this issue. And I think what you described is interesting, that the technology may not necessarily replace people. It might just free them up to be retrained and repurposed for the high value activities that might give them more dignity in their work, might have them be paid a little higher. So the whole process maybe becomes efficient, including for the laborers, as long as we can retrain them for those new skills they need.
Yes. And that starts to sort of border on very large topics that can be quite political. But from my point of view as a person in robotics, I think that this question is the question. It's less about, do we want to automate this low quality job or not? I think the answer is yes, we do want to automate the low quality jobs. The bigger question is, what can we do to help these people have other means of good quality work given that? And in farming, there are very obvious examples. On farm, there's something else that's not being done that a robot can do. But in other industries, it may not be so clear. I remember talking to somebody, their mother had worked in like a phone operating facility, and pretty much overnight, in I think it was the 70s, 500,000 Americans lost their jobs when those systems became automated. But it was a good thing for the country. And it was actually a good thing for his parents. And it just takes sometimes a little bit of time in the transition period to make sure that people are being taken care of and retrained, and that there are opportunities for work so that people can have a means to survive and a means to live. But I do think that the bad jobs, the low quality jobs, should be automated.
I think that's so well said. Yeah, it reminds me of these analogies. Like, if this makes the cost of coffee less expensive, then that might increase the value of sugar and cream. And so, like, things just move around. It's not zero sum,
right.
But there's a lot of work to do here. Coming back to the technology itself, you've kind of commented on this a little, but can you give us all an example of, like, what's some, like, the coolest thing you've seen AI or machine learning or some of this in your ag tech world do? Like, what's just like a really incredible thing that you probably couldn't even have imagined a few years ago that you've experienced?
Yeah, well, I can tell you, I came at this from the business side, and my co-founder was the deep engineering experience. And I remember when I first wanted to start this business with him, he had just bought a camera off of Amazon and within a day had sort of trained it to see blobs of color as fruit. So he'd like take some berries from a tree and throw it on a surface. And I thought that was amazing. And that was 5.5 years ago. I said, oh my God, I can't believe that this is where the technology is. But today we have models that make far more sophisticated judgments about what is happening out in the farm. How difficult is a certain piece of fruit to pick? And from what different trajectories can we pick it? And how do we choose that? And how do we learn every time we pick from that decision? You know, there's this whole area in AI of reinforcement learning, policy learning, where you learn every time you do an action and you get better and better and better over time. And that's being applied now in our business and in other businesses. And this is the kind of specific artificial intelligence that is very, very powerful. And that is where I think AI is going and will have the most traction in the next couple decades, is judgment calls or specific tasks that they actually get better than humans at doing relatively quickly. I know there's a big question at the end, so I won't spoil my answer, but the artificial general intelligence question is a different question entirely. But today, I think these judgment calls and learning from what you do and getting better and better as time goes is really cool and is being applied today in the real world. And a decade ago, that stuff was still the stuff of PhD papers and not really applied yet.
I know there was the classic example of, you know, if you want to teach a baby or a young person what a cat is, every time they see a cat, tell them to say cat. And then there was this challenge with computers that every time it's or a cat, it has to know it's a cat. And the more it sees this, the better it gets. And I think that's kind of at the core of what this stuff is doing for us. And I guess with technology, we can do it more, faster, larger data sets to study, et cetera.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a very exciting time because I think it is so early. Society is aware that this is happening, but it's still very, very early days in applying a lot of these advancements in AI and machine learning and robotics to the real world and making it value creating, value accretive, as opposed to just a cool tech demo. And that's where the next couple decades, I think, are going to be really exciting.
I started doing this podcast, The Q Factor, about 4 years ago, and the idea was to interview and talk with people that I could learn from and my guests could learn from that are using data and technology to do interesting things. And just in the 4 years that I've been doing this, I've just watched the world fly by. I mean, it's just amazing how quick this is moving. And I've been really studying it and thinking about it across many industries for only really 4 or 5 years now, but it's happening. It's amazing.
Oh, yes.
I feel like I could talk to you for hours about all this stuff. I'll keep going though. You mentioned your co-founder a couple of minutes ago, Tim Brackbill, I believe, your CTO, your co-founder. Tell us a little bit more about him, your business. How did you guys meet? How do you complement each other? I mean, let's talk a little bit about the business side of this. I also know, like, I mean, you're a pretty impressive guy, you know, BA from Stanford, Harvard Business School, McKinsey advisor. That's pretty intense. Who are you guys? How did you meet? Where did you grow up? What is all this about?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I think I identify more with what we're doing now than what I've ever done before. And that's sort of the same for Tim. Tim and I met at McKinsey. We had very different paths to that place, but we both had an interest in learning about how do we actually build something in the world that's doing something meaningful that we believe in. And it turns out, if you go all the way back to our roots, I mean, both of us had grandparents that were farmers on both sides. Tim grew up in the Pennsylvania farm country. His earliest memories of engineering were helping his grandfather fix broken tractors on the farm. My grandparents were on my mother's side in Australia, farmsteading in Western Australia. And on my father's side were outside of Toronto, Canada, growing cattle. And my grandfather lived through the Great Depression on a farm. And I think these kinds of lessons and sort of deep things about what farming is and how important it is for society and how hard work really drives everything didn't really fully start congealing until I was in my late teens and in college and post-college. But for me, the journey was, you know, I grew up in the Bay Area around the internet being born. And then in my college days, I was around many friends and close acquaintances, you know, starting to join and build and actually found some of the businesses that are household names today. And I knew that this sort of world creation and technology applied to the real world was really important to me, but in the right way and for the right reasons. And I didn't particularly have an interest in things like social media, but I went around the world for a year after I graduated and realized what I really, really cared about and wanted to devote my career and my life to is the human environmental relationship. Like, how do we balance that? And there are really major industries that interface the most with our environment. That's energy, agriculture, and waste and water. And Tim, in his own journey, was sort of growing up in farmland, went to Berkeley to get his PhD in mechanical engineering and worked in a bunch of startups in biotech and biotech automation in the Bay Area and realized the same kind of thing. Like, he wanted to use this technology, but to apply it to something he actually cared about and that actually meant something to him in a more sort of philosophical and values-based way. And so for the next 5 to 7 years, we were both going through our journeys and then met each other and realized, oh my God, we have the exact same sort of idea from two very different angles. Tim brings an incredible depth of engineering expertise across many, many disciplines. And I came having focused mostly on agriculture for the last 5 years of my life prior to founding Tortuga. And so we kind of came in and spent 2 to 3 months basically moonlighting nights and weekends, figuring out what are some things that we believe in from a mission standpoint that we also think are really, really big business ideas. And we wanted to find an idea that was a huge swing, a massive risk, but a massive opportunity. And we sort of came up on a couple ideas, and Tortuga was one of the ones that we were most excited about. And here we are 5.5 years later. So that's a bit of the origin story.
That's amazing. It's cool that you guys are grandchildren of farmers. You both had farming in your family. And I think like a lot of entrepreneurs, no matter what they're doing, your genuine connection to this must be meaningful for what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I think so. And it didn't happen where my whole life I knew I wanted to be in farming. And some people have that. But when you reconnect with these roots, I particularly had a couple moments, these real epiphany moments where I realized, no, this is what I want to do. This really connects to me deeply, both from a familial standpoint, from a values and philosophy standpoint, and also from a business standpoint, what I'm interested in, what I know about. I feel like I can do this job. I feel like I can create some value here. I can help out. But it also ties to my roots and my beliefs around hard work and my beliefs around where I want to spend my time on this earth to help grow food, for example, which is extremely important to everybody on the planet and important to the environmental systems that we depend upon. Having grandparents in there was, I think, a really wonderful reconnection to my roots when I started realizing this is what I wanted to do.
I'm sure the passion that I'm hearing so clearly comes through to all of your customers, suppliers, and your team to get on board with that, which is exciting. This connection you also made to the environment, water. Water is something I've had a long-term interest in, and the challenges with water globally. Of course, that impacts farming everywhere. Things like climate change, environmental issues. How does that show up in your business? Do you see your technology and your business being able to contribute to some of those solutions?
Yeah, absolutely. We think that our mission is to do this exact thing. And the main way that robots help is because robots are essentially the new operating system for a farm. And that changes sort of everything about how those jobs get done and what information you gather, all the things we've been talking about. And the real lever on that for something like carbon, for example, is reduction of waste and improvement of the intensity of a hectare of farm growing land, you know, of production property. If you can do a better job more efficiently with 1 hectare and produce the same amount of food and waste less of it, that is massively impactful to the environmental system that we depend upon on the farm. Another element of this, which we've kind of touched on but haven't directly talked about, is we're designing our robots for sort of structured and controlled environments, which is a simple technology as like a light cover over, farmland or a glass house or a greenhouse. These are very, very sort of traditional technologies, drip irrigation, for example. But if the robot fits into that system better than it fits into a ground-based sort of conventional agriculture system, then robots will help those farms, which are more sustainable already because they control the environment, they reduce risk, they use less water, they use less fungicide and fumigant, they use less fertilizer, and they waste less, even better on all those dimensions, then that kind of technology will continue to outcompete the 20th century broad acre or large scale conventional chemical heavy approaches. So we see the robotics sort of directly helping on farms as well as helping a certain type of farm to outcompete and to provide better product to the consumer while also reducing the environmental impact on the ecosystems around the farm.
Amazing. So a couple last questions I had in mind. I'm wondering, in your experience, your travels, to share with our audience, what are some other particularly interesting disruptors that you've seen in ag tech? Companies like that real game-changing approaches to what's going on out there. Businesses other than Tortuga that you're seeing that you might want to share with us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned one already, which is AFresh Technologies, close friends with those guys and appreciate what they're doing. I have another friend who started a company called AgriWeb, which is basically a farm OS for cattle farms. And so similar idea, right? By helping a farmer better manage their business and manage their inventory and manage their processes, you can significantly improve how they do their job. And then they can actually add other valuable add-ons to that product to help from the inside out kind of change how a farm operates. That's a big one. There's a huge and rapidly expanding world of regenerative agriculture, which many people may not have heard about on your podcast, but it's essentially the idea that if you manage your soil better, you can improve your farm's economics, improve the quality of the soil, and actually, for example, sequester carbon. So by having a living soil, you'll have less carbon floating free in the atmosphere and more carbon, quote unquote, temporarily sequestered in the soil. I'm very interested to see where this goes because there is definitely a kernel of truth to this idea and there's a lot of value here, but there's also so much noise all of a sudden in the space. I think it's too early to know that who exactly is actually creating sustainable value and where there's vaporware, but I do think that this is an area I'm very curious about focusing on and paying attention to. And then the last area that I think is a huge area and a growing area is crop biologics, which again, you know, in the 20th century, we kind of had this dead soil mentality of we're going to have a relatively sterile soil and we're going to pump all the nutrients and all the control chemicals in that we need. And that's how we're going to grow our food. But crop biologics is the idea that you put a living being or multiple things like bacteria or fungi, and they actually interact with the plants in beneficial ways. And they can help improve nitrogen fixing or help improve nutrient movements or help improve resilience against pest pressures. So putting living things, crop biologics, in the soil to help improve your yield or your resiliency, that area is also super interesting to me. And there's a number of really cool companies in that space. But I think all in, outside of robotics, which I'm very biased and think is a very, very important area in agriculture and ag tech, whatever is providing direct, tangible, measurable economic value or risk mitigation value or improvement of quality to a grower, those are things that are really taking off right now. And that's what's exciting to see.
Interesting. We met through a good friend, Tom Hillman of Lewis and Clark AgriFood, and they're actually an investment firm thinking about all of these kinds of things. And I'm so thankful that he introduced us. And I think it's firms like that that are out there just thinking about this all the time. Like there's so much to know and so many interesting companies, with yours, of course, being at the top of my list, which is why we're here talking. Really interesting what you're doing. And I love the name of your company. You want to tell us all why Tortuga?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, turtles in cultures around the world are thought of as symbols of wisdom and patience and connection to the earth. And we thought that was a really meaningful symbol as an animal. And also tortuga sounds way cooler in Spanish than turtle does in English. So we went with tortuga. We're very fortunate, actually, that tortuga is quite easily pronounceable in many, many languages around the world. And we found, you know, pickers and farm workers on the farms that we work at all around the world speak many different languages, but tortuga is a word that many people can hear, understand, and pronounce. It's actually quite helpful. So we got a little lucky there, but mostly it was the symbolism of the turtle around the world.
I was in the Galapagos Islands with my family probably 10 years ago. You ever see those turtles there, how big they are?
Absolutely. They're beautiful. Yep.
So cool. One practical thing for our listeners, I'm curious about this. You know, you could buy organic or not. You can go to Whole Foods or the local supermarket. Does it really matter? Like,
yeah.
Like, what's great going question. On with all that?
I love the question. And I honestly think that the main thing to say is that most people who know a whole lot about it would probably say there's so much noise, but you can have some general rules or let's say guidelines that'll help you be in the right direction. And for me, I'm trying to eat less and less red meat. When I do eat red meat, I generally try to eat red meat that's from relatively premium, relatively regional, maybe not hyper local, but sort of regional producers. I'm in Colorado. I buy buffalo meat, which is sort of leaner and also more sustainable, typically because those animals are better evolved for the climate that we're in. I do tend to buy organic. I know there's a lot of noise around organic, but I think directionally, organic is probably better than a more conventional soil approach. But things like hydroponics, or, you know, there's a lot of lettuces or tomatoes being grown in glasshouses that are probably more sustainable and aren't being grown in soil. They're being grown in fake soil and they're not organic. And so if I know relatively roughly locally, there's some hydroponic tomatoes or hydroponic lettuces, I'll buy those. I don't think there's any easy answers, but going away from mass production and mass processed food is probably better. There's sort of Michael Pollan, the famous phrase, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. You know, I think those are the useful guidelines as opposed to having any hard and fast rules, because there is a lot of noise in the space. And I generally think we're going in the right direction, though, by buying a little more premium if you can.
So last thing, we've got three questions that we ask all of our guests every time, no matter what their background and or what their experience. We call them the three Q's. And I'd like to ask these of you. And the first one is, in what field or sector do you see big data having the biggest positive impact on the world over the next 10 years? Now, it can be science, manufacturing, investing, philanthropy, global health, climate change, anything at all. Over the next decade, where and how will big data help the world the most?
I think it's a great question. Obviously, as an expert in agriculture, I'll have to say ag first, but I also think it's pretty clear that big data is helping to make massive gains in things like biology. There's a lot of work being done on targeted therapeutics or protein folding, which is maybe more like AI. But these areas are, I think, really exploding in terms of what we can do with the data that we've been gathering and analyzing it. I don't particularly know if climate change is the area here, because I think we already know the broad strokes of what we need in climate change. And I think what we really need is massive infrastructural change across agriculture and energy and water and waste. But in biology and in those areas, I think big data seems to be making a whole lot of gains.
Thanks. And how about the flip side? Where in the world do you see things being the most threatened by big data over the next 10 years, where it's really our enemy?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've sort of seen this play out in the societal realm in the last, call it, 20 years. I think big data and sort of a lot of this machine learning and AI approaches have followed the path of least resistance in their inception into targeting human behavior on our basest instincts. You know, I was an early user of Yahoo and then Google and then eBay and Facebook and Instagram. And there's just an incredible amount of compute and intellect going into how to keep our eyeballs glued to screens. And a lot of what's happening is we're creating filter bubbles and we're creating sub-communities that are polarizing. And this is actually a pretty negative impact on our society and on the fabric of our society. I think there's some major concerns about things like surveillance capitalism, which is a whole other question entirely. But in my mind, I think it's sort of the path of least resistance has taken us to this place where big data has helped to cause some serious societal friction and rifts that I think are not necessarily needed to be there. And I think we could also do a lot to help alleviate those challenges, hopefully with the same technology.
Makes sense. That third question, which you alluded to already, my third question, which is, you know, artificial intelligence specifically, is it our friend or is it our foe?
Yeah, I think it's a really fun question. I think friend. And I think it's because ultimately, as I mentioned, ASI, you know, artificial specific intelligence is a tool. And it's a very valuable tool, but it's quite limited. You know, it's very focused on one task or one thing. Artificial general intelligence, the idea that we're going to have a super intelligence, I think it's quite difficult. And I personally think it's potentially very far off. And even if it isn't that far off, to have that thing be a danger, to be a foe, it will require, I think, a lot of physical world manipulation or access to certain systems and capabilities that are very difficult to actually do, especially in the physical realm. What I have learned in robotics is it's quite difficult and quite complex to even do a simple task for humans. And so I think that AI is a friend.
Eric, thank you so much for being our guest today. Please thank Tim as well. I look forward to our continued discussion and staying in touch. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was my interview with Eric Adamson, who is clearly doing great things in the world. You can learn more about his work and mission at tortugaagtech.com. As always, I'd love it if you could give this episode a good review and rating. It only takes a moment, and it really does help. I'll see you next time for another episode of The Q Factor. Thanks for listening. I'm Greg Fisher.
Greg Fisher is founder and portfolio manager of Quent Capital, a registered investment advisor. Economic and market views and forecasts stated by Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital are current as of the date of this podcast and are subject to change without notice. This presentation is not intended to be a solicitation of any kind. It is for general informational purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results. The views of the guests that appear on the Q Factor are their own and may not reflect the views of Mr. Fisher or Quent Capital.